You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 8th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me today are Bob Novella.
Hello.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
Perry DeAngelis.
Righto.
And joining us again is Jay Novella.
I'm back, my brothers.
Hi, Jay.
Welcome, everyone. I'm back. Good evening.
Welcome.
So, a couple of interesting news items this week. Scientists have discovered the earliest ancestor of Tyrannosaurus Rex. T-Rex is, you know, obviously the most famous dinosaur. It's the one that kids love. So they found a T-Rex ancestor unearthed in China. The Chinese have dubbed this species Guanlong, which means crowned dragon. So this is a smaller, obviously much smaller than the T-Rex. It's a
That's why T-Rex is cool, because he's like a real dragon.
Yeah, he's huge. This is a smaller ancestor. He with a crown crest on its head. They think that may have only belonged to the males and may have been a device for attracting females. So a lot of theropod dinosaurs have been discovered in China.
China rocks.
Yeah, I mean,
I was just going to say there's been a lot of fossil discovery, especially lately, coming out of China. Some pretty important stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's where all the feathered dinosaurs are coming from, which of course are theropod dinosaurs. They're related to in the same group as T-Rex. Those were the two-legged carnivorous dinosaurs.
Well, labor's cheap out there. They probably got 20,000 guys digging, you know?
No, that's part of it. But, you know, with fossil finds, it's all about finding a geological strata that is well preserved and that dates to a specific period of time. You know, and it's, you know, it has to be accessible. So either it's in a cavern or it has eroded to the surface, whatever. So there are, you know, different locations are essentially different windows into a specific period in the past. And, you know, paleontologists are always hunting for new windows to periods of time, times and places that we haven't seen before. So they've just found an excellent window into a period of time when theropod dinosaurs were abundant. And they've been just pulling tremendous numbers of fossils out of the ground. It's great.
It's also good that the government, you know, which is, you know, not exactly the freest government on Earth, allows this sort of scientific activity to happen and,
right.
You know, what is basically, sounds like pretty open means.
Yeah,
well, there's no political content to it, that's why.
Right, especially for an atheistic country, you know.
Right.
Sure.
And also, there's still a certain amount of international prestige associated with scientific discovery.
Unfortunately, China is also probably one of the most notorious areas for forged fossils as well.
There has been at least one forged feathered dinosaur fossil, which was, you know, sniffed out by the paleontologists. They did not fool the experts, but because they essentially pay people when they find fossils, it's a good way to sort of get people to go out there digging for fossils. But it also creates a market for fakes. So paleontologists have to be on the lookout.
How hard is it, Steve, to get a fake past a real scientist for a long amount of
time?
It'll
never hold up. It'll never hold up for a significant amount of time, especially now. You know, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, when there were fewer, gold standard specimens to compare it to, it was easier. There was the famous Piltdown man. although that was... Again, there was very few human fossils at the time. This is around 1911 when that was dug up, and so there was nothing really to compare it to, and it fit the preconceptions of what scientists at the time thought that an early human should look like, basically a primitive body and an advanced, you know, cranial capacity. So basically the forger, whoever it was, took a human skull and an orangutan jaw. And then, you know, filed away the parts where they connect together, so you couldn't test to see that they actually connected to each other.
And he stained it, I believe.
He acid stained it, aged it, and it got past the initial inspection. But the thing that most people don't realize is that those fossils, as soon as they were discovered, casts were made of them the original fossils were locked away and that the scientific community really only had the opportunity to investigate the casts, the copies.
Oh, that makes sense.
They never really got their hands on the original fossils. And then, of course, what happened is over the next, you know, 20 years or so, 20, 30 years, as slowly more hominid fossils were dug up, they started to look more and more different from Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man became marginalized to the point where, you know, by 20 to 30 years after it was discovered, everyone was basically ignoring it. It was a total outlier. It had no relationship with all the real fossils that were being dug up until someone finally said, this just isn't right. This can't be right. So they you know, got the real fossils out of the vault. They drilled through the bone, and once you get down through the aged surface, it was not fossilized, you know, actually bone, not fossilized bone beneath that. So it was, the skull was maybe hundreds of years old. You know,
there's that pesky scientific method again, you know.
So that was that. Today, of course, there's many more fossils. People are much more on the lookout. You know, there's much more technology to assess the actual original bones. So it'd be much more difficult to get a fraud. With the feathered dinosaur fraud, they were real. I think they were real fossils, but they were again combined from different specimens in order to make it appear as if a dinosaur had feathers.
So, Steve, what you're saying is they look at the bones.
Look at the bones.
Steve,
you got to go to the original evidence.
Didn't National Geographic showcase those forged fossils at one point?
Well, they had one issue, which was a great issue, that it showcased about a dozen species of feathered dinosaurs and lots of specimens, but that was just one of them that was thrown in there.
Okay.
It had to be later recanted.
But also, the Piltdown Man case also showcases how human psychology plays into science, because the forgery fit into the contemporary conception of
yes.
what this would look like to such a degree that people accepted it probably, you know, in hindsight, far too readily, especially when you consider that tests that were available at that time would have easily detected
But they didn't look.
The methods. But they didn't look. And of course, they were locked down, which would have made it harder. But it would have been very easy to shoot them down permanently.
There were two things about the Piltdown Man fossils that made them so emotionally acceptable to the scientific community at the time. The first is that they were discovered in England. And the English scientific community, of course, there was a certain amount of national pride to say that man evolved in England. And it also reinforced a lot of the racial prejudices at the time, you know, that the more advanced, you know, human species evolved essentially in Western Europe. So it fit the prejudice of the time. The other thing was, again, people had the conception that the human ancestors that were sort of like halfway between ape and man would have had a human-like brain in an ape-like body. That was the conception, and that's what Piltdown Man was. In fact, what we discovered was very human-like bodies with very ape-like brains. The truth turned out to be the opposite of what the preconception was.
You know, also that guy, when he created that fake, in order to really sell it that it came from England, he gave it horrible teeth.
That's right.
Oh,
you know what's
geez.
Interesting, though? in the second find, there was an elephant bone that looked suspiciously like a cricket bat, and to the point where people joked about it. And in retrospect, it was, you know, if they thought it was just a coincidence, they sort of joked about, oh, look at, you know, Piltdown Man had played cricket. But in retrospect, people have speculated that maybe that was supposed to be a clue that it was fake, that it actually was intentionally made, you know, a real cricket bat in there. The next item that caught my interest this week is a study that was just published. A low-fat diet may not reduce cancer or heart attack risks. Now, this was a huge epidemiological study involving nearly 50,000 postmenopausal women.
Wow.
I'd like to take this moment here to say for all fat people of the world, we told you so.
Well,
you.
Not too quick.
Continue.
Basically, what they did was they divided the women into two groups. They gave one group counseling specifically for a reduced fat diet, and then the other women went on eating whatever their usual diet was. They followed them for 8 years, and they did not find any statistically significant difference between their incidence of heart disease or breast cancer or colon cancer, which, And the reason why they were following those specific things is because they were earlier, smaller studies which suggested that there may be a benefit to either colon or colorectal or breast cancer with a low-fat diet. So this is, you know, again, a larger, longer study. So the best data we have now indicates that there is no generic advantage to a low-fat diet for those.
I believe this
studies.
Is often referred to as the Rolls-Royce of studies, is it not, Stephen?
You mean this?
Because of the size and the $415 million budget.
This is a big study.
Definitely, three times today I heard it referred to as the Rolls-Royce of studies.
Now, there are some details to the study that are worth noting in terms of interpreting the implications of the study. One is that the women were followed for 8 years. Now, that seems like a long time, and it certainly is a long study. But for diet health risk factors, a much longer period of time may be needed. This doesn't say what 20 years of a low-fat diet would do. The second thing is that although the women were given counseling on a low-fat diet, there really wasn't any way to validate that they were actually eating a low-fat diet.
I'm sure they took that into account, though.
And, well, how can you, except to say that you don't know what they were actually
ridiculous.
Doing.
That's ridiculous.
The third thing, and this is the biggest thing for me, especially with the heart disease, is that the women were although they were counseled to have a low-fat diet, they were not counseled about good fat and bad fat. In other words,
that's because the study was done in the 80s, was constructed in the 80s.
Right. Now, since then, certainly in the last 5 to 10 years, what has been discovered is that an overall lower fat diet actually, if anything, may increase your heart risk, your cardiovascular risk. That in fact, it's much more important to have the good cholesterol, the HDL cholesterol, what you would find in nuts and vegetables, and a reduced amount of the LDL, the animal fat cholesterol or fat in your diet. So therefore, you know, the study is basically obsolete, even because it took so long to design and carry out that it really is. They counseled women to do something that is not what the current recommendations are.
But Steve, there's another point.
I mean,
they might have been counseled to have a low-fat diet, but what about? But that doesn't mean you were fit. You mean you could have a low-fat diet but still eat tons of other stuff and be overweight and unfit.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I would
right.
say a low-fat diet is just a means, you know, if part of a program which also includes, exercise to get fit, and being fit is what would prevent all those things.
Yeah.
Well, right. I mean, they're not saying anything about weight here. The weight, there's no indication whatsoever. I mean, some of these women are obviously going to be larger than the others.
I mean, it's sometimes we do studies which are called like an intention to treat study, and it's basically designed to see if healthcare providers do a certain intervention, what's the bottom line end result in the real world with real people and their compliance rates, etc., not in the artificial world of a study where you're monitoring things very closely. Does that make sense? So, like, for example, if I, as a physician, write 100 prescriptions for aspirin to prevent heart attacks, what's going to be the actual real-world result of that intervention, as opposed to verifying, you know, that I have 100 study patients on a specific dose of aspirin and verifying their compliance and et cetera, et cetera.
Do they measure compliance rates of studies? I mean, is there an average that you can kind of guess at?
There are ways to measure compliance. One was just to ask patients, were you compliant? And then there are more sophisticated methods. There are some studies that have incorporated putting computer chips into the caps of the pills that you give patients, and it records every time you take the cap off and put it back on the bottle.
There are ways around that, too.
And then you could also, for drugs that could be measured in the blood, you could measure their blood levels of the drug to make sure to tell if they're taking it and how much. So anyway, there's a lot of limitations to the implications of this study. And some of the articles I've read in the lay press cover that. You know, like this one, this is breaking news from thenewscientist.com. So this is a good outlet. Quotes people who know how to interpret the study. For example, Judy O'Sullivan at the British Heart Foundation told the BBC, "The diet didn't reflect current advice for good heart health, such as salt reduction, increasing intake of good fats, such as those in oily fish, and increasing exercise." So It doesn't really mean that fat is okay or that the current advice is not working. It just means that just reducing total fat is not the shortcut to either to reduced risk in these areas, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, and heart disease. It's unfortunate because it doesn't really add that much to what we already know, because again, the specific advice they were testing is already a little obsolete, but it's also likely to confuse the public by the way the lay press may boil it down to, you know, low fat is not healthy after all, you know,
right.
Just sort of the incorrect bottom line to take away from this. I thought we would review a couple of websites this week. Occasionally in the past we've drawn attention to some good science websites or skeptical websites. Evan, you sent me both of these. These are two excellent sites which focus on myths in science, or myths taught in as science or in science textbooks.
I was doing just a little research, and I typed into Google basic science questions. I wanted to see just, you know, what was kind of being taught to either elementary school kids or middle school kids. And, of course, I came across a couple of these sites. And, you know, it just even took me by surprise. There's a couple basic things here that I always thought or was taught that were true. And, you know, boy, did I find out I was wrong all these years.
Yeah.
So, you know, even us skeptics or people who understand science still have a lot to learn. Even on some of the most basic principles of science.
Maybe you.
And maybe me. But I was surprised.
A lot of these are, basically, this is the website, the first one that we're looking at is Modern Myths Taught as Science by Kenneth Fuller. He has about 20 or so common statements that are probably widely believed, but are subtly incorrect. For example, the notion that heat rises is, if you ask people, does heat rise? Most people would say yes. And there is, of course, a kernel of truth there, but it gets boiled down in the way that it's taught so that you miss the real essence of the underlying scientific principles. In fact, heat has no tendency, heat itself does not rise or fall or anything. Heat simply spreads from hotter things to cooler things. That's just basic thermodynamics, whatever direction that involves. It is true that warmer air will tend to rise above cooler air, you know, relatively warmer versus relatively cooler, because it's lighter. The air with molecules with the greater energy will tend to be, on average, be a little bit farther apart, and therefore it'll be a little bit lighter. And lighter gases or fluids will tend to rise above heavier gases or fluids. So again, there's some truth to it, but there's the real underlying scientific principles are distorted by this oversimplification. And he gives a lot of excellent examples of that. If you guys recall, just the other day we were chatting about this one, the Earth rotates exactly once in 24 hours.
Yep.
Yeah. And in fact, that's not quite true, because the Earth also travels around the Sun in a day, and therefore it has to rotate an extra degree to put the Sun back into the same position. So a solar day, the time it takes for the Sun to go from, you know, noon to noon is 24 hours, but the time it takes for the Earth to rotate around once is slightly less than 24 hours.
But not the Earth rotating around the Sun.
That's
as in regard to a year.
Yeah, but that's revolving around the Sun. The word rotate refers to it's on its axis, and revolving refers to the Sun going around the Sun. So that's the difference between a solar day and what we call a sidereal day. Yeah, so the time it takes for a star to go from the same position back to the exact same position is like 23 hours and 56 minutes. It's an extra 4 minutes to get the Sun back into position, because we've gone around the Sun a little bit during that day of
right.
our orbit. So it's subtle things like that are taught slightly incorrectly.
The taste map of the tongue is wrong? I didn't know that.
That's true. Now
I heard that.
That is incorrect. It's based, however, on it's a misinterpretation of what's really going on. What the map of the tongue is based of is there are differences in the different parts of the tongue, but it has to do with the innervation. Different nerves supply different parts of the tongue, but that doesn't mean that the taste is evenly segregated. It's not, taste is not evenly distributed around the tongue, but there aren't these just discrete zones where you can only taste one, like salt in one place or sour in another.
I recall learning that a real long time ago. It was either elementary school or middle school, and I never thought that never sounded right to me.
Yeah.
Right, that you couldn't taste something, say, bitter in the back of the tongue or the side of the tongue. It just never sat right with me.
It's really easy to test it out yourself because we all have tongues. So just
right. Most of us have tongues.
I remember seeing the diagrams in school.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well,
sure. Oh, that must be true.
Very important information, right? We all need to know exactly why and where the tongue tastes what. But
the geography of my tongue is very important.
I got to tell you, to this day, to this very second, I still kind of believed it.
Yeah, well, why not? You're taught it in school. You see the picture in the textbook. You never have an occasion to hear the real information, so why wouldn't you? The one caveat, though, to testing the taste yourself is that if you put a little bit of sugar in one part of your tongue, if it dissolves and spreads through your saliva to the rest of the tongue, then that's not a good test. That's something we have to be careful about. Like, there are times when, as part of the neurological exam, I may need to be able to see if somebody could taste on one side of their tongue versus the other. And you have to be careful not to let them swish it around in their mouth.
Hmm.
But anyway. So
are there neurological disorders that just relate to the tongue, Steve?
Oh, well, sure. I mean, the tongue has nerve supply. It's a muscle. You can have the inability to taste, or paralysis of the tongue, just like anything else. Usually those are in the nerves, just because the innervation in the brain is redundant bilaterally. So
my father, who suffered from diabetes, certain advanced diabetes later in his life, started to lose his ability to taste.
Right.
And
really?
For the last few years of his life, he had a hard time distinguishing taste that he used to, and he was a chef, so he had a very, very good palate for such things. He lost it as the years went on.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Although most of that was probably really his smell. Most of what we think of as taste is actually our olfactory sense, the first cranial nerve, not our taste buds. Taste buds are pretty dumb. They can taste, salt, savory, sweet, sour, bitter. And all of the other richness of flavor and subtleties of flavor is really all smell.
If you hold your nose, you cannot distinguish, and close your eyes, you cannot distinguish between an apple and an onion.
Right.
Hmm. Really?
Both are equally sweet.
As long as I never lose my taste for meatballs, I'll be fine.
Nice calamari.
I'm there with you, Jay.
How about this butterfly emerges from a cocoon myth, apparently?
Yeah, well, again, the butterfly has a chrysalis. Which is an outer coating, but it does not weave a silk cocoon around itself. Only moths do that.
I saw it in a cartoon once. What are you talking about?
Right.
I did, right after the tongue cartoon. They had
the
butterfly cartoon in fifth grade.
Now, the other website, which is closely related, is Science Myths in K-6 Textbooks and Popular Culture. Again, the URLs you'll find on our website on the notes page to this podcast, but you can also just search on those titles and you'll find them. And this is the same thing, but basically looking at the quality of the content in textbooks, and which is universally awful. Now, one particular item caught my attention, and this was an article written by Dr. Richard Feynman. Now, Feynman was an excellent physicist and an excellent science teacher, a popularizer of understanding in physics. And this is an article he wrote in 1964, which was published by the Textbook League, which apparently is an independent group that is like a watchdog group on the quality of textbooks. I actually emailed them to try to get somebody on our show, but they did not respond. But maybe we'll get them on a future show, because this is certainly a topic that we can come back to.
Yeah.
But this article, I read the whole thing. It really caught my attention. Basically, Feynman is describing his experience on a California committee to evaluate math and science textbooks for their quality control for their public school system. And to give you the highlights, he says that, first of all, the other people on the committee had no idea what they were doing. They were not scientists or mathematicians. They were just educators or administrators, but they didn't have any knowledge base from which to draw in order to assess the actual content of these books.
Like most school boards.
Right. The other thing was that when he was added to the committee, he got sent all the textbooks to evaluate, that the publishers called him to, quote-unquote, help him evaluate their books. Basically, they wanted to explain to him the content of the books. And to Feynman. He said, I'll judge the books by themselves. I'm sure they speak for themselves. And didn't speak with them. When he reviewed the books with the committee, his assessment was very different from a lot of the other people on the committee. And there was one book in particular that he didn't even get and that other people had rated. It turns out that this one company, which had three books, one of the books was not ready at the deadline for the review. So they sent us the cover of the book with blank pages in between. And like 8 out of the 12 committee members reviewed the book that had blank pages in it. Which basically means that they submitted a review based entirely on what they were told by the publisher, and they were surprised in the meeting to find out that the book actually had blank pages in it. They obviously never cracked the book to actually take a look at it. So Feynman was very disgusted that that's what he was dealing with. And then the other thing that happened was just bureaucratically, once they did make their recommendations, and then it went to the next step where they decided to change the budget, so they had to go back and alter their recommendations based upon the changes in the budget. And the whole process was reversed, and in the end, he ended up resigning in disgust. But he tells his description of the textbook still holds true today. And the criticisms basically are that the people writing these textbooks don't know what they're talking about, and they get everything wrong. Everything is just not quite right. All of the science is either subtly or grossly incorrect. This relates to reinforces what we had discussed on a previous episode, was the idea that the education community thinks that they could teach science because they're educators, even though they don't understand the science itself. And basically what Feynman's impression of these textbooks was exactly that you cannot teach a subject you don't understand. You'll always get it just a little bit wrong. So, unfortunately, that is still the state of things. Now, what I'm interested in is what this group is up to, this textbook league, is doing. Are they an advocacy group, or do they just publish articles? Are they actually trying to lobby school boards or textbook companies or whatever? Anyway, it'd be interesting to see what they're up to. So hopefully we'll get a representative of them on our show in the future.
This topic is very disturbing.
Absolutely.
It actually, I think back to when I was in school, and my favorite books that I got were my science books. Those were the ones that I was interested in most, and I probably spent the most time actually reading things in those books that weren't assigned to me. And to think back on the fact that those books could have been riddled with misinformation actually really upsets me.
Right. Absolute misinformation, and just, so how can you expect the public to learn the real science? So here's one example that he gives. There was a chapter on energy, and it showed a wind-up toy, a kid on a bike, and a plant, growing. And said, what makes all these things go? And he's like, okay, I could see where they're going with this. This is a discussion that, I have with my students, my father had with me. The idea that, the spring makes the toy go, but somebody has to wind up the spring. And basically, and whoever winds up the spring has to get their energy from their food, and the food gets its energy from the sun. And the basic scientific concept that is important in all this is that energy is never created or lost. Energy just transforms from one state to another. And in doing so, going from sort of more concentrated to more diffuse energy, it can do work. But it also becomes more diffuse and gets used up in that process. But it doesn't go away. It just turns into ultimately into just dissipated heat energy, which can't do any work. So, but those scientific concepts were completely missing from this chapter. And as he turned the page, the answer was, what makes the wind-up toy go? Energy makes it go. What man, the boy on the bicycle? Well, energy makes it go. And that was it, just a word, energy, with no understanding of exactly what was happening, or thermodynamics, or the concept of work, or heat, or anything. And it was just completely vacuous.
Steve, was it designed for kindergartners?
No. Or? This was it was grade school. I mean, it was it was at an appropriate age when they should have been learning about things like the principles that we discussed, like energy is not created or destroyed, but just transforms from one state to another. I think even very young children can understand basic concepts like that. I mean, there's no reason not to teach it to them correctly from the beginning. So, and that was just one example, but everything was like that. Just the real scientific concepts were missing, and they were replaced by these watered down, vacuous nonsense, basically.
So, where is the almighty United States government helping in this regard? Like, you'd figure that they would want to be involved in things like this to guard against it.
Well, I mean, in the State of the Union address, Bush, talk the talk about supporting science education, but there's nothing concrete there, so it remains to be seen.
Of course, whatever he has to say about science, we better listen.
Yeah. Right.
He learned years ago that it was energy that made everything go.
This is the our president who endorses intelligent design.
No. Okay. He's a scientific boob.
He doesn't have a good track record. But anyway, the other thing is that the federal government has no control over what gets taught in schools. That's controlled at the state level. So we have to fight the 50 battles in 50 states. That the states have the science standard. Remember, the science standards were the big fight. That was the big battleground a few years ago over evolution, starting with Kansas State School Board removing both evolution and the Big Bang from their state science standards, which of course dictates what gets taught in class, which dictates what the textbook publishers put in their textbooks. But of course that was then reversed a couple of years or the year later, and then it was reinstated, I believe, when yet another school board was elected. So that is still an active battleground. It's at the state level, not at the federal level. Well, let's go on to I have one email this week. I'd like to read your emails on the podcast. This one is from an individual who's just gives, I think this is their first name, A-U-K-E.
Auk.
I guess that's pronounced Auk.
Auk.
Auk writes, "Hi, I stumbled across your podcast's webpage a few weeks back, and I'm addicted. Congratulations to you and the podcast crew on a job well done. I come from a town called Stellenbosch near Cape Town, South Africa." Then they write, "Curious minds need to know these things. How are you related to the other novellas? I guess calling you a trilogy wouldn't be a novel joke to you. Regards, Auk."
Actually,
thank you.
Well,
thank you.
Actually, I did email them back, but Jay, Bob, and I are all brothers.
You are?
But Bob is.
The truth is out.
The truth is out. We are all bros, which I think we've said briefly on the show before, but I don't think we spelled it out.
I haven't heard the term trilogy, but here's a quick little anecdote that was funny. Steve, remember in high school? We were in high school, and there was a girl in high school that actually thought Steve and I were the same person until she saw us together.
Right. So for like 6 months. Went through the 6 months of the school year thinking we were the same person until we were both in the same room together.
Now, guys, think if you knew that she thought that, you could have messed with her so bad. There was so much potential fun there that you blew it.
If they were devious like you, Jay.
Didn't know it until the gig was up, though.
And actually, there is yet another novella brother that doesn't do the podcast.
That's right. There's a lot of us.
Sadly, he was abducted by a UFO. Cannot join us.
That's Brother Joe.
On our weekly podcast.
Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
All right.
Each week, we come up with three science news items or facts. Two are science, one is fiction. I will challenge my panel of skeptics to see if they can figure out which one it is. This week there is a theme. The theme is animals. So these are three facts about animals. Ready?
Go ahead.
Ready.
Number one. A recent study shows that large numbers of coyotes infest American cities, hunting at night largely undetected. Item number two, scientists have discovered that animals can infect other animals with cancer through their bite. Item number three, a new species of lizard was discovered in the jungles of New Guinea that gives birth to live young. Evan, why don't you go first?
I was reading some stuff about New Guinea earlier this week. I don't know specifically if that was one of the discoveries they made on the remote New Guinea island, in which they discovered quite a few new species of stuff. So I'll tend to think that one's true. Number two, a bite that causes cancer? I don't know. That one sounds really far-fetched. However, Steve, knowing you, you found something to make the most crazy sounding one probably true. So therefore, based on that, I'm going to guess number one is in fact fiction.
Okay, Jay, why don't you go next?
Well, I know for certain number one isn't fiction because I know that there are coyotes everywhere across the United States, and they're one of the number one reasons why people lose their pets, which is interesting.
Right. Although this specifically says that they're infesting cities.
Then I take that back. I don't really go for that. I must have been sleeping when you said it.
Let me reread. A recent study shows that large numbers of coyotes infest American cities, hunting at night largely undetected.
I took that kind of as cities, I live in the city of Danbury, Connecticut.
No, it's big cities in the middle of, in urban areas.
You didn't say that.
Yeah.
You weren't quite clear with that. Confused.
Let me clarify.
Okay. So I would go with the lizard one as being false.
Any particular reason?
I have absolutely no information on the cancer-causing bite. I couldn't even begin to comment on it. It sounds a little hokey to me, but for some reason I think that's the one that you're trying to stump us on, so I'm going to go with the lizard one as being fake.
All right, so we got one for the coyotes in American cities and one for the new lizard giving birth to live young. Perry?
Well, the first one sounds perfectly reasonable. That sounds true. The New Guinea one, my first inclination would have been to think that was a trap because there's all the New Guinea news out this week. They found the lost Garden of Eden or whatever. Hundreds of new species of plants and animals. But the second one, I didn't think cancer could be transmitted like that. I didn't think it was could be infected. I thought it was a gift from God. So, I think number two is false.
Okay, so we got one for one, one for two, one for three. So we're spreading, you guys are spreading yourselves out.
Okay,
this
Bob.
Week.
Bob, come on,
Bob. You got to break the tie, Bob.
Happen.
I pick option four. Now, actually, congratulations, Steve. These are all
They're good.
Implausible.
Well, I took it easy on you guys last week, so I wanted to come up with something a little bit harder this week.
That was a little lame. This is definitely harder. Coyotes in cities seems the most plausible, so maybe I should pick that one, but I'm not.
That's what I did. That's what I did.
An animal bite can cause cancer now. Well, let me skip that for now. Lizards can give birth to live young. I could imagine a lizard species that somehow, has an egg, a real conventional out-of-the-body egg, but that somehow dissolves in the body, so it's not really laid. It's just kind of dissolved, and the baby lizard is born that way. I could imagine that. More so than the second one. The second one, animals biting, causing cancer. Now I know there's some theories of certain diseases like heart disease caused by different types of infections. It was recently proved in the past decade that ulcers are caused by some sort of infection, bacterial infection, I believe, in the stomach. And that kind of makes me think.
But this is a direct transmission of cancer, not an infection.
Oh, okay.
Not infection with a virus or bacteria that then causes cancer. This is direct transmission of cancer through a bite.
Oh, let me reevaluate that then.
That's pretty. If that's true, I really hope it isn't. God, that's nasty.
That seems to me that would have been would have entered my radar. Because that's pretty damn big. So I'm gonna go with two and say that is false.
Okay, so we got 1 for 1, 2 for 2, and 1 for 3. Let's start with number one. That is true. A study mainly in Chicago showed that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of coyotes living in the city, in the urban areas.
Wow.
Essentially hiding during the day. They're nocturnal. They hunt at night, mainly rats and small animals.
Good.
Certainly can snap up pets. They tend, when they're in the cities, as opposed to when they're out in the wild, they tend to hunt alone. But they will occasionally, if they come across other coyotes, they will occasionally link up. But
now, Steve, to bring up something interesting, it's kind of the same. The area outside of cities is not too different than, you know, a populated town that's not near a city.
Right.
So I can definitely see that.
Because
I know that they live around here, and I know that, you know, we have a dense population here, so there's plenty of places for them to hide and plenty of animals for them to hunt. So I totally
agree. But I think
the
new thing here was that this is like in the middle of Chicago. Not on the outskirts. This is in the middle of the cities.
But why the apparent lack of sightings? Sightings.
Because they come out in the wee hours of the morning, basically. They're nocturnal.
Like the aliens.
And they're stealth hunters. You know, they're small.
They're very elusive.
You know, the
thing
is,
elusive.
If you see them,
you think
probably
they're dogs.
Most people just assume it was a dog. You see something at night at 2 in the morning,
good point.
You know, most people probably see them and assume that they're dogs.
Good point.
They smell like cabbage.
When I used to hunt, we never saw coyotes. We always saw traces of them, their spore, their footprints, or everything, but boy, you'd never see an actual coyote.
But no big feet either, huh?
I think it would be, imagine how scary it would be. You're walking down the street, you've been out with your buddies having a couple of drinks, it's 2 in the morning, and you see 10 dog-like animals come around the corner.
Yeah. A pack.
That's not good.
Jay, at 2 in the morning and drunk, you'd take them on.
Hey, maybe Bigfoot is nocturnal. That's it.
And drunk.
Wasn't nocturnal when they shot that Patterson film, but that's another story.
Go to three, Steve. Go to three.
All right. Number three, a new species of lizard was discovered in the jungles of New Guinea that gives birth to live young. Now, Perry was right in as much as the New Guinea thing was my trap.
Right.
I know you guys saw that.
Yeah.
And it was certainly plausible that some, you know, interesting, fantastical new animal was discovered there. I almost went with a six-legged mammal, but I thought that would have been too much.
But I got
a couple of you with the lizard giving birth to live young. I think that would have been bigger news. I mean, a reptile giving birth to live young would have been huge news.
Yeah, that's impossible.
It's it happened eventually. I mean, they evolved into mammals that did give birth to live young.
That's true.
So it's not impossible, but that would have been huge if that were discovered. So that one is fiction. Number two, guys, is correct.
Wow.
This was specifically in Tasmanian devils. And there's a small population of Tasmanian devils. They are, I believe, endangered. And they're being wiped out by a rapidly spreading skin cancer that is occurring mainly in the face and neck area. And what they discovered was that the animals were basically directly passing the cancer cells to each other through bites from either courting or competition for reproduction, you know, male-to-male competition.
Sorry.
So it is, again, it's a direct transmission of cancer cells, not like an infection that causes cancer.
But that's a new thing. Not interspecies?
It's in the same species. It's between Tasmanian devils.
Oh, why was I thinking that biting a human?
No, just animals.
That's because that scares you. That's why.
that's funny how I could also almost convince myself that that's what you said. Okay.
Nope.
Are you saying the cancer cells that are transmitted through the bite, they like cling on to the cells?
Yeah,
they set up
shop and they start to proliferate.
Incredible.
They also think that because the population is rather small and inbred, that their immune systems may be weakened, and that the cancer cells are able to take a foothold because of their weakened immune systems.
And if they're inbred, they'd be more genetically similar, would make them more of a target.
Right.
Right.
Steve, just out of curiosity, did you read that they are in danger of because of this?
Yes. Oh, yeah. They're already sort of a small population, and they're worried this could wipe them out. So they're actually starting to separate the animals now, the healthy from the diseased. Now that they know that they can actually catch it, one from the other, through the biting, they're separating the animals.
Well, Bugs Bunny is very happy that the Tasmanian ducks are going down in population.
It's the largest surviving carnivorous marsupial, the Tasmanian devil. Very interesting animal.
They have a pouch.
Very interesting.
They are both marsupials.
Guess that's why the Warner Brothers chose them.
They don't spin around like crazy like that, though.
Oh, sure they do. I saw it.
Wait a minute. I better check that science myth page.
Yeah. So again, a little bit of a tougher one this week, guys, to make up for the easy softball I fed you last time.
Good job, Doc.
That was good. Very good.
Softball, because we got it right.
You all got it right.
And we rarely sweep. That's true. Rarely.
That's true.
One more item this week before we close. Perry, you sent this to me. This is an article published in the Philippine Daily Inquirer.
It's the record, paper of record in the Philippines. I have no idea.
You want to read that one for us?
Well, it said, obviously not going to read the whole article. It's just written by a person who was on a show with a scientist, and the person was basically defending that there are other ways of knowing beyond the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
Basically saying at one point that the main problem with the scientific method one of the main problems is that it's fine if you want to prove something is physically true, then it's okay to follow a strict scientific method, right? So say mm-hmm. physically true. Guy says he agreed completely this. But what if you're dealing with non-physical reality, says, for example, ghosts, astral projection, paranormal phenomenon, things clearly outside the scope of science.
Right.
How can we rely on science to guide us, he says? We could not because science is wrong, but because it's not meant to tackle these areas.
Right.
That's kind of the thing he's saying in this piece.
But I kind of agree with that.
Okay, Jay.
meaning that science can't prove or disprove things that aren't based in reality.
That's right.
But then what could possibly do that?
Nothing. That's right. But that's the rub. So in a way, he is correct in that science is limited. Science cannot answer any possible question that you could think to ask. It could only answer scientific questions. Questions that can be tested, that can be investigated in some way.
Yeah. He says the scientific method, it's my problem is not that it's wrong, it's that it's incomplete.
Right.
Says.
Oh. But where he goes wrong, he's making a huge logical fallacy called the argument from final consequences.
Oh, yeah.
He's basically saying that science, has a limited realm, which is true, and therefore science cannot know about anything outside of the scientific arena, which is true. And then here's the logical fallacy. He says we need to know, or we want to know about things outside the scientific arena. Therefore, we can know those things using other ways of knowing. But it's actually the more logical conclusion is that we simply can't know about things that are outside the scientific realm. Again, we can't know about things in a factual sense. I'm not talking about subjective feelings or emotions or whatever. I'm talking about knowing things that are, say something about our position in the universe or whatever. You can only believe things. You can't know things outside.
According to this guy, he says there's thousands of other ways of knowing.
Yeah,
thousands.
But they're just ways of believing,
right?
Not of knowing.
Know. Human beings have a very
that's where he goes wrong.
Understanding or grasping unknowable, right? And they're not very comfortable with that concept.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to see anything fall into that category. Unfortunately, there's a lot of stuff that falls into that category.
Right. Now, here's two paragraphs I want to read, though, from this guy, too, that is another thing that he writes. He says, it was Dr. Rhine who coined the term extrasensory perception, ESP.
Yeah, I was just about to point that out.
Right, to refer to that ability that seemed to go beyond the five senses, a kind of sixth sense. Though the work of Dr. Rhine had many detractors in the scientific community, no one ever proved that his conclusions were not valid. What a load of crap. First of all, they were proved not to be valid because no one's ever been able to reproduce them. That the methods were refined, and when they were refined, the effect went away. That's how science works.
Right.
That's how science proves they're not valid.
This person was probably trying to, when he said that, I think he meant that nobody proved that he was wrong in that those specific instances were wrong, which you can't really do. It's replication. It's a replication you want.
In the next paragraph, he says, more recently in the 70s, Dr. Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff at the Stanford Research Institute proved human awareness could be projected to a specific location, which a person had never visited before, allowing him or her to describe it accurately. Both scientists have PhDs in physics.
Ah, right there.
So what logical fallacy is that
argument
last sentence?
From authority.
Argument from authority. And this is, I think we in fact just touched upon this last week talking about James Randi. And this, the Targ and Puthoff experiments are the classic example of how scientists, in this case physicists, were completely naive and ignorant about methods of deception. These two guys totally blew it. They had the wool pulled over their eyes.
They were completely
deceived.
Absolutely.
They don't. Now they're just idiots. But they were completely deceived. Completely deceived by simple magical tricks. You guys know one of the people that they tested that they quote unquote validated.
Uri Geller.
Yeah,
in the 70s.
And he hoodwinked them, and it was clearly demonstrated that he did so.
He didn't hoodwink Randi.
I read a full book about it.
He is a very talented mentalist.
He is.
I mean, the guy is very good at his craft. You have to be very much aware for him not to trick you.
Randi made him look like a flaming boob on the Carson show.
I'm not disagreeing. All I'm saying is that scientists don't necessarily think skeptically when it comes to things like this.
Of course not.
So that's why he was able to come in there. Right. He pulled his parlor tricks, and those two guys completely ate it up.
Perry, to be fair, I mean, if Jay's talking just about his skill as a mentalist, no magician can perform when another magician is basically who knows how to do their tricks makes it impossible for them to do their tricks. I mean, that's the whole point. Randi knew what he was doing and set up the situation in such a way that he couldn't do it. He couldn't, whatever, blow the pencils. They spread the Excelsior around. So, it's like you pull the curtain back and you see the man behind the curtain shows over. That's what Randi
The difference
does.
Is the claims, though.
Yes, the difference is that, and as Randi hits it on the head, he says, if Uri Geller is using mystical powers to bend those spoons, he's doing it the hard way.
That's right.
Randi said he can't prove that he's using sleight of hand to do what he does. All he's saying is that all of the tricks he can do by an amazing coincidence are ones that other magicians already know how to do with simple sleight of hand, and that he does them in such a way that it's perfectly compatible with the sleight of hand method. So there's no reason to think that he's doing it miraculously. And yet, that's what Targ and Puthoff concluded. They've gone on to do other notable, nonsensical work in the ESP area.
Puthoff's a huge zero-point energy.
He went on to be, he's a full-fledged pseudoscientist now, that guy.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds somewhat feasible, the whole zero-point energy idea, but I think it's generally accepted that the whole zero-point energy, extracting energy from space is just not plausible or practical. You would need, some estimates I've heard of, you'd need a parcel of space, say a mile by a mile, a square mile all around, and you'd be able to, if you had that and you could take out the zero point energy from that space, you could light a light bulb for a minute, something like that. I mean, it's just not.
I heard you would need a space equal to the solar system to light a light bulb.
Well, it's
maybe,
okay.
Maybe that was not accurate. But
it's big.
The bottom line, yeah, there's a whole zero point energy thing is very interesting. We could do a whole segment on this.
Right.
There's certain amount of energy in the quantum foam of the universe, But one, no one's been able to prove that you can get access to it, that you can actually use it to do work. It may be there just like heat is there, but you can't use it for anything. And two, there's no reason to believe that it's a huge amount of energy. Now, granted, right. We don't really know how much energy is there, and we can only go on the current consensus of opinion. But in the absence of any evidence that we can access any a significant amount of energy with zero-point energy technology, it's right now it's pure speculation.
According to the sixth-grade textbook, it just says energy here. So I'm willing to take that at face value.
Energy is energy.
Steve, I think the idea is that if space was so dense with energy, that dense as they claim, that you would have particles spontaneously appearing. I mean, it would be noticeable. The actual energy would,
right.
I think it would have such a detectable presence that it would be obvious that there's a huge density of energy in the
there would be virtual particles popping in and out all over the place.
Well, they do. There are virtual particles popping out even in the vacuum of space, but it would be on such
much
a
more
huge
dense.
Scale. That's such a huge scale.
Yeah.
And it's one other thing, Steve. Another misconception, the original writer of that article about how science is inadequate, not to the task. It's a common misconception. It's easy to say and to believe that science, can't deal with things that are, metaphysical, things that are outside. But
right.
But the problem is that in a sense, the human body is a scientific instrument of sorts. I mean, if you say you had a ghost sighting, if you say that you have ESP and that you can project your conscious, the fact that your body can accomplish these things and sense these things means, by definition, that you can also create
right.
or design a scientific instrument that could do a much better job of doing it and, in effect, do science to verify that claim. So
that's
it
cool,
doesn't
Bob.
Wash. It does not
very
wash.
Cool. You're right.
No, you're right. Actually, I was going to make that point, and that's why I brought up those two paragraphs. You did. I mean, you honed in on the same thing I was. The next thing to say about the Dr. Ryan and the Targan Puthoff paragraphs is, if he's saying that these phenomena are beyond science, then why quote scientists who have validated it scientifically? That is the inherent hypocrisy of this whole thing. They say, oh, science can't deal with these topics. Science doesn't have the tools to deal with it. But we know that they exist because scientists have shown that they exist.
Yeah, not only that, Steve.
Then they quote this crappy pseudoscience.
He dropped names, too.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They quote references which have been discredited in the scientific community.
If this guy really, who knows what the original television show was like that this guy's referring to? But if this scientist who was with him really was this pathetic in his defense of the scientific method, then, it seems to me he was a scientist in name only.
Right.
But we're getting one side of it after the fact, so
I think
who knows?
Well, there were two guys there, so there was the scientist and an astrologer, right?
Yeah, right. I know.
So the scientist looks like he was saying reasonable things,
But not enough.
I don't know. I didn't see the show. It's hard to know based upon – we're getting it filtered through whoever wrote
this article. He concludes his piece with this. Many other scientific studies in this field were done in Russia and other Eastern European countries. To say there is no scientific proof of psychic phenomenon is to betray one's ignorance on this very important field of knowledge.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. So he makes a vague reference to research without any specific references. And
Russia and Eastern Europe.
Russia, yeah, right.
So can we say that the author is this week's jackass?
This pseudoscientist of the week, I guess.
Pseudoscientist of the week?
Yeah, the author of this article is a gullible fool, basically.
Yeah, was,
again, it's typical, you're not aware of this 3-foot stack of evidence that we have. Well, how about just showing me just one good study? And then we'll start there, and then we'll go from there.
He's a
then busy we'll go to the
man.
Next good study.
He's too busy to have to prove to any skeptics what's
going on. I would simply refer you to Dr. Ryan's work of the 40s, that's
right.
All.
And the bottom line is, no, we're not ignorant of the huge body of evidence. I've read reviews of most of it, although there's always new stuff. The bottom line is the scientific community has reviewed it, and it's all crap. It doesn't add up to anything when you shine the light of real science onto it. And typically what happens in the ESP community is they come up with some experimental design, and then they get alleged positive results. They get peer-reviewed. So they point out errors in the methodologies. The errors in the methodologies are corrected. The effect goes away. Then they go on to the next experimental design, and the process repeats itself. That's been happening for over 100 years, and they never make any forward progress.
Never.
They never get to the point where they can refine a research technique and reliably show an effect. That is the pattern you see when there's no there there. There is no effect or phenomenon there. It's all in the minds of the researchers.
Steve, what are you trying to say about this important field of knowledge?
That it doesn't exist.
God's
I think that Ramsey's million-dollar challenge basically trumps everyone at this point.
It does. It does. I mean, all they could do is make personal attacks against him, but the bottom line is the challenge is there. It's fair. There's nothing they could say about it except that they cannot pass it.
I mean, you designed the challenge. What could be more fair than that? Just claim what you can do, design your test, and test it.
As long as it's verifiable.
Right.
It just has
as long as it's
verifiable,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was convinced that I had some sort of paranormal ability, think about it. You would win, first off, just to cap it off, to start it, $1 million. Here's $1 million. Can you imagine the notoriety that you would get? It would be unbelievable, and nobody's tempted to do this.
Steve,
nobody.
How many people have taken the test, do you know?
What do you mean nobody's tempted to do it, Bob? Hundreds of people.
Well, Randy says hundreds of people have officially applied.
But apparently the true believers will say that, you know, or if you confront someone individually, they will say, well, they'll give you a lame excuse.
But that's Bob. That's the con artists because they know that they can't pass the test.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
What Randy said was, and I've spoken to him about this, initially a lot of people of all kinds applied for the test. You had the con artists and the true believers. And then word got out that there's no fool in Randy. That Randy actually knows what he's doing. And if you try to pull the wool over his eyes, you'll fail. Then over the years, the people who have actually submitted themselves to testing have become more and more and more deluded true believers and less con artists. So now he's getting just the real nutcases.
Right.
Which is
evident by the people we've screened out.
Right. The people that we've screened.
Oh my God.
We're definitely towards
but
the nutcase end of the spectrum.
My point is, if I'm a believer, if I just happen to believe in paranormal and pseudoscience, don't these people think, well, why hasn't anyone really won this? I mean, why?
Because they think he cheats. They just, oh, he must be cheating.
Right.
They just dismiss it without really
he's not
the
fair
data.
That he's cheating. His tests
really
are one-sided.
$1 million.
Don't you guys think it's a little odd that more people actually haven't submitted? You know, hundreds doesn't seem like that many to me, and what that leads me to believe is that
a lot of charlatans.
I think that a lot of these people steer away from it because you'd figure they would try it just for the, you know, right, 1 in 10 million chance that they'd hit.
This is, you know, again, there's a lot of hypocrisy there, and this article really shows it. This whole false duality of saying that, oh, you know, you can't be submitted to science, and yet whenever they want to, they'll grab onto scientific evidence. It's totally self-contradictory. But we'll have to end on that note because we're out of time. Guys, it was enjoyable as always. It was a good show.
Good show. Thank you all.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information about this and other episodes, visit our website at www.thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kenetto and is used with permission.
Last theorem, let him far from the mainstream. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems.